Stand, please.
Oyez, oyez, oyez. A person's having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-3052 et al. United States of America versus Rashad G. Tate, also known as Ra, appellant. Ms. Rowland for appellant. Ms. Curry for appellant. Richard E. Young. Mr. Eisman for appellee.
Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court, Sandra Rowland on behalf of Mr. Tate. The district court believed that the 2009 amendment to the crack guideline adjusted the crack powder ratio from 100 to 1 to 20 to 1, and it imposed a bottom of the range sentence, believing that that sentence reflected somewhere in the neighborhood of a 20 to 1 crack powder ratio. The government doesn't dispute that this was error, but argues that an appellant is entitled only to plain error review and that appellant cannot meet the prejudice prong. It's our contention that the error was preserved. After the judge said that the 100 to 125 month range was based on a 20 to 1 ratio, the defense counsel corrected her and said, no, the recalibration of the sentencing guideline does not bring it down to 20 to 1. I think it's more like between 60 to 80 to 1. He was correct. It was actually exactly in the middle. It was 70 to 1. Nevertheless, the court made a finding.
So the court was then correctly informed that it was 60 to 80 to 1.
She was correctly informed.
And then that was the end of that.
No, that was not the end of that. Immediately after he told her that it was not 20 to 1, she said, all right, and I'm quoting again, all right, so, and I will say that we've talked about it, and it's not exactly 20 to 1, as you point out, but it is in that neighborhood. That was part of the two-level reduction that the Sentencing Commission recommended. Mm-hmm. So although he was
this
able
all
to...
This started when the district court challenged the defense counsel's statement that it was 100 to 1. And the district court says, no, because we have the 2007 amendment, which reduces it from 100 to 1.
And 20 to 1.
Right. And then the defense counsel corrects that and says, no, it's not 20 to 1. It's more like 60 to 80 to 1.
So he was
And the district court says, okay, in the neighborhood. But it seems to me the key is that the district court knew it wasn't 100 to 1 and also knew it wasn't 20 to 1, knew it was somewhere in between. But it ultimately didn't matter because the guideline range was what the guideline range was.
Well, I had two responses to that. One is that the judge thought, despite what defense counsel said, that it was somewhere between 60 to 1 and 80 to 1, the judge apparently didn't absorb that information. He was able to budge her off of the notion that the guideline change had brought it down to 20 to 1, but she still believed that it was in that neighborhood and said, it's not exactly 20 to 1, as you point out, but it's in that neighborhood. It's our contention that even 60 to 1 is not in the neighborhood of...
Well, she asked then what 20 to 1 would be, and the defense counsel didn't know.
Right. Well, what it would have been at the bottom of the guidelines was 70 months, which is substantially different than
70 to 87 as opposed to 100 to 125.
Right. She believing that she was somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 to 1, she felt that he should get the bottom of the guideline range. Had she actually been at 20 to 1, the bottom of the guideline range would have been 70 months. I wanted to address
what she knew it wasn't 20 to 1.
Well, yes, she did. But I think if you look at her words and take them at face value, she says it's not exactly.
The word neighborhood, you're pinning the whole thing on the word neighborhood?
Yes. It's not exactly 20 to 1, as you point out, but it's in that neighborhood. if she had absorbed the information that it was somewhere between 60 and 80, I don't think she would have considered that to be in the neighborhood of 20. Judge Kavanaugh, you said that it ultimately didn't matter because she wasn't.
She wanted to know what the guideline range was, and you agree she correctly calculated the guideline range, right?
Yes. Well, she correctly accounted the offense level.
Yes.
Correct. Is that what you mean?
Yes, that's what I mean. And then she wanted to do that and then apply the 3553A factors. And it didn't matter to her what the precise ratio was because she never came back and said, I want a sentence based on
I don't think that's
ratio.
A fair characterization of the transcript. She was very concerned, and she said, I'm very concerned about the disparity, and what am I supposed to do with Mr. Brewer, who from the Department of Justice, saying it's recommending to Congress to go to 1-to-1. But, again, you know, I am pinning it on this word neighborhood. I think she said what she meant and meant what she said. It's we're in the range, we're about 20-to-1, and that seemed to be a ratio that she was comfortable with. She did not seem to be comfortable, certainly with 100-to-1, and she knew we weren't there
anymore.
The
last thing she was told was that it was 60-to-80-to-1.
Yes.
And you just think she, as you said, didn't absorb that? I don't really get that.
You know, mistakes are made.
I understand.
That's why we have all those Fed thirds. But, you
many
know,
of them
she
are
said,
affirmances.
Pardon me?
Many of them are affirmances.
Well, they are, yes. But I would say that I think 15% of them are not. You know, I can't explain why she heard the information and didn't seem to take it in. She still thinks she's at about 20-to-1, and that seems to be what she was comfortable with. She was worried about the disparity.
But don't you think, as a district judge, if you just said that's what she was comfortable with, that if you wanted to do 20-to-1, you would say, I want to do 20-to-1, and I want to know what the calculation for 20-to-1 is?
Well,
And neither of those two things appears.
Right, because she thinks that the 2009 amendment really substantially changed the calculation, and so that she is in that neighborhood. You know,
well, it did change it pretty significantly, right? It bumped it down about 2 years.
Right, but you know why she isn't, you know, sort of absorbing this information that, no, you're not in that neighborhood, I can't say. But certainly as to the standard of review, he asked for what he wanted. He told her the correct information. And he's not then required to come back and say, no, you know, keep disputing what she's finding. He gave the right information. If I could jump to...
I was going to ask you, if you were to lose on this, what about your second argument, the Spears argument? I'm not suggesting you will, but I just want to be clear as to whether or not you think that's a complete win or not in terms of getting you back.
I'm sorry, that I think which is a complete win?
Your second argument about the district court's failure to acknowledge that she had the authority to depart essentially based on a policy disagreement with the commission.
Right, that she, it's our contention that she was going to defer to the sentencing commission, those people who spend their lives doing this, and who is she to choose a different number?
Well, they did discuss Spears at the hearing.
Yes, they did.
So,
yes,
and we assume normally that judges understand the law, and Spears was discussed. And is there anything in the record that suggests she didn't understand it?
Well, only her words about that. You know, I'm going to use a range that was developed by people who have spent their lives doing this instead of, and I think she used the word throwing a dart and making my own decision.
She sort of suggested she couldn't figure out a principled way to do anything else. I mean, she was thinking about it. She realized she had the discretion, but seems to have chosen not to exercise it, or chose not to exercise it.
To the extent that she chose not to exercise it, I think she did understand that she had discretion under Spears, but to the extent that she decided not to exercise her discretion, I think it was because she believed that the disparity had been largely taken care of. I think that she also believed, and she said, that she was sentencing him acting on the assumption that she might see him again and have another opportunity at this. I think my argument on that third issue would be weaker if she had said, I'm assuming, but she said, I am acting on the assumption. I am sentencing you based on the assumption that I will see you again, and we'll have the chance to redo this after the crack guidelines and the crack statute has changed.
All right. Why don't we hear from counsel for Appellant Young?
May it please the court, my name is Kavitha Kumar Puri, and I'm here with my colleagues Justin Antoni Pillai and Wells Bennett on behalf of Appellant Richard Young. The court is well aware of the issues on appeals, so I'll be brief and I'm happy to take any questions you have for me. The first issue is whether the safety valve provision codified at 18 U.S. Code Section 3553F requires a defendant debrief with the government in order to qualify for the sentencing reduction. The government argued very strongly below that there was, in fact, a debriefing requirement, and the district court erroneously adopted this view. There was at that time, and there still currently isn't, any case law from this circuit squarely holding that there is no per se debriefing requirement. And so while the government concedes on appeal that, in fact, there is no requirement, this erroneous instruction needs to be corrected for precedential purposes. We ask that the sentence be vacated and remanded for a proper instruction as to Mr. Young's safety valve eligibility. The second issue is whether there needs to be a remand for the limited purpose of a factual finding as to whether Mr. Young's safety valve submission, that is his proffer, was truthful and complete. Because the district court disqualified Mr. Young at the threshold, it never reached the question of whether Mr. Young's safety valve submission or his proffer was adequate to qualify for the sentencing reduction.
Now, isn't the threshold issue here whether Young was required to identify the supplier or suppliers?
That was, in fact, information that the government pointed to that was missing from the proffer, but a fair reading of this record suggests that, in fact, that the issue was whether or not Mr. Young had to debrief and provide that information.
Well, I thought the district court, in the second hearing at least, recognized that there was not a per se debriefing requirement, but the language of the statute requires that the defendant truthfully provide to the government all information he has concerning the offense or offenses that were part of the conduct. And here, it boiled down to whether the defendant had identified who the supplier or suppliers were.
Yes, Your Honor. The court did say a debriefing in the full sense of the word may not necessarily required, but went on to say, and this is at Joint Appendix 135, went on to say, quote, you either have to talk to the government and tell them everything you know, or I will sentence you to a mandatory minimum of 60 months.
And what's wrong with that under the language of the statute?
It's the form of disclosure. The court, having taken upon itself to instruct Mr. Young as to his eligibility, tells Mr. Young that he has to talk to the government and tell them everything he knows.
Well, you could write it, presumably, but it's either got to be one way or another. You have to provide it under the language of the statute, right?
That's correct. You have to provide certain kinds of information, but the form of disclosure is not specified in the statute. And if I may, Judge Kavanaugh.
Well, I guess my question here is the issue really the form of the information, or is the issue the substance of the information, namely As I read this, it all came down to, tell us who the supplier is and you'll get the safety valve. Don't tell us who the supplier is and you won't get the safety valve.
Judge, the form of the disclosure is very important here. If we could step back for a moment and think about what this instruction means to a defendant like Mr. Young. The government had said repeatedly in its memorandum of aid of sentencing, at the sentencing hearing and in other places, that Mr. Young has to sit down and talk with us and tell us everything he knows. And now the district court is adopting that language and instructing Mr. Young personally, you have to sit down and talk with the government and tell them everything you know. And so while we may understand that Mr. Young might not have to answer every question the government now has for him, Mr. Young thinks in order to be eligible for the safety valve, he has to accompany a government official to 555 Ford Street with anyone who's in and around that building seeing him, talking to the government, potentially answering every question they have, painting him as a snitch of the highest order. And that's not what the statute requires. He could have disclosed that information in a less threatening and less scary way.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. Let's assume for purposes of what we're now talking about that we read what the district court did differently than you do. Just assume we read the district court as having ultimately said that the problem here is that pleading guilty and accepting the government's proffer in whatever form is just not enough. So then it boils down to the question Judge Kavanaugh was asking you, which isn't it true then that his refusal to either say who his supplier was or say he didn't know is the problem here?
Your Honor.
You see my point?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I think that the form of the disclosure is quite important, but to the question
But I was trying to take that off the table.
Right. Okay. To the question of what he had to disclose regarding the drug transaction.
You agree he had to disclose that in some form, if he knew.
Exactly. He had to disclose what he knew
about. In some form, if he knew.
Yes, that's correct. But what we don't know is what he knew about the transaction other than what counsel below represented. Ms. Katkish, on behalf of Mr. Young, twice
represented. Well, she took the position, her lawyer took the position that all he had to do was plead and accept the government's proffer, nothing else.
And she also.
And that was wrong, correct?
If as a factual matter, the proffer is in fact everything Mr. Young knew about the.
But we don't know that. He never said that's all he knows. It's one thing to say, yeah, it's all true. But something else to say, yes, it's all true, and that's all I know. He didn't say that, did he?
Yes, Judge Tatel, there's twice on the record where Mr. Young's counsel represents that it's everything he knew about the transaction.
Really? No, not about the transaction, about his source.
Well, we don't know what Mr. Young knew about the source.
That's the point.
It's not on the record.
That's exactly the point.
And I agree, Judge, that this is exactly the point, and this is why the case needs to be remanded for a factual finding as to what Mr. Young knew about the supplier. Was it nothing? Was it something beyond the proffer? The district court never undertook that analysis. And absent that analysis, anything we talk about here regarding the facts of Mr. Young's knowledge is really speculative.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought the district court, after saying, essentially, you have to tell us who the supplier is, then said to the defense counsel, you want to take a moment with your client, talk about what you want to do.
Yes, there was a brief recess after the court instructed Mr. Young to talk to the government and tell them everything he knew. But at that point, we don't know whether Mr. Young would have acquiesced to providing additional information to the extent he had it in another form. At that point, the only thing that was on the table was a debriefing. And it's clear that Ms. Katkish.
What would be the other form?
It could be a letter from either Ms. Katkish or Mr. Young to the government. It could be by way of affidavit. The district court could have closed the courtroom and said, I'm asking you here and now, Mr. Young, do you know anything beyond the facts of your proffer? Your counsel has twice represented that you don't. I need to make a determination as to whether you're credible.
Did the district court ever say putting it in writing is not good enough?
The district court never said that, never really used any words other than talk and debrief.
Okay.
Your Honor, I notice I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Counsel for the government?
Ben Eisman for the United States. Good morning. The district court did not commit any plain error in imposing Rashad Tate's procedurally reasonable sentence. In fact, Judge Collier repeatedly recognized the advisory nature of the guidelines, she considered arguments, as this court just observed, in which Spears, Kimbrough, and Gall were expressly cited and discussed.
It is, let me just ask, on the standard of review, haven't we said already that if you raise an objection and the judge goes forward, you don't have to re-raise it?
Which objection is the court referring to?
The first two arguments that are at issue here, where appellant argues it is not plain error review.
Let me start with the argument that the court failed to understand its own discretion. Plain error is applicable there because it was available to Mr. Tate's counsel to object if he believed, if he actually believed that the court was going off the tracks and didn't understand in having a discussion about how she should exercise her discretion, that that discretion existed in the very first place. And with respect to the error of her purported reliance on a 20-to-1 ratio, as the court observed just now, there was further dialogue in which the court said, well, I've had this discussion with the probation officer. We believe that it's in the neighborhood of 20-to-1. If, in fact, that was an error, then it certainly was available again to Mr. Tate's counsel to say, actually, Judge, that is incorrect. And plain error certainly is the applicable standard of review.
Well, the defense counsel had already said that by saying it was 60-to-80-to-1. I think that's Judge Rogers' point. Do you have to then go back and say it again?
We would submit that that is the case because defense counsel appeared to agree with the judge. He agreed that the probation officer was the person to whom we defer on these matters. And the judge indicated that her discussion with Ms. Cave, the probation officer, was what led to the conclusion that the cracked powder ratio was in the neighborhood of 20-to-1. And I would also note, just as a general matter, without respect to the precise mathematics of Mr. Tate's particular ratio, the Supreme Court in Kimbrough observed that the 2007 amendment did, in fact, bring the crack powder ratio down, depending on the base offense level, to from 25-to-1 up to 80-to-1. So even if we are in the realm of error, it certainly would not be the realm of obvious error. But more importantly, I'd like to go back to a comment that Judge Kavanaugh made, which is that ultimately this didn't matter. And the reason that's significant is because under Gall, we're not concerned simply with whether there was a factual misstatement or misapprehension by the district court. It is a form of procedural error that the district court select a sentence based upon clearly erroneous facts. And that based upon is of the essence to this inquiry. And here we have a situation where Judge Collier went through each of these 3553A factors, and she found that she had before her a man whose recidivism was, quote, quite alarming, who evinced a total lack of respect for the law, who had been totally undeterred by the criminal justice system, who indeed had just distributed $1,000 worth of crack, 63 grams, at the drop of a hat, while he was on probation for possessing a loaded semi-automatic weapon, and while he was out on bond for driving a car that had $13,000 worth of crack hidden in its secret compartments, along with another loaded semi-automatic weapon. Carefully analyzed those factors, and that's what led her to conclude that the sentence yielded by the guideline, which already reflected the two-level drop from 2007, was sufficient but not greater than necessary for this defendant. And that is the overarching instruction under Kimbrough, to impose a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary. That's what Judge Collier did here. Now, as to whether she understood her discretion, again, it's unreasonable to assume that a judge who was participating in a conversation about Kimbrough, about Spears and Gall, would have misunderstood the central point of those cases.
Could I go back to the standard of review? In Mr. Tate's reply brief, he has some argument about this. What's your response?
Which particular argument, Your Honor?
In the reply brief at page 3, talking about how you preserve an error before the district court.
Question.
He cites Rule 51B of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure and then cites a case from this court. And Rule 51 says, quote, a party may preserve a claim of error by informing the court when the court is ruling or order is made or sought of the action the party wishes the court to take, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we've said, we believe that an appellant in a criminal case may seek clear error review of a sentencing without regard to whether the appellant requested findings objected. So we contrasted to that, to the situation where the district court was informed of the defendant's position and was on notice.
Well, certainly.
Not as though the defendant is coming up here raising a new issue for the first time that he hadn't brought to the district court's attention.
Well, certainly there was no objection raised with respect to the issue of whether the court understood its discretion under Beers and Kimbrough. With respect to the 20-to-1 ratio issue, I don't want to give the impression that we're relying too heavily upon the plain error.
I thought you were giving an impression very clearly, counsel. That's the only reason I went back to it.
We happen to think that plain error is applicable here. The case that we have in mind actually is Watson, the 2007 case, in which the district judge mistakenly believed that the statutory maximum was 240 months. And based on that mistaken belief, said, I'm going to give you 108 months because it's so far below the maximum. And in that case, which we think is the most analogous situation to what's presented here, the court applied plain error. But speaking more directly to your point about error preservation, again, we take the position that the error, if any, here is whether the court selected the sentence based upon a clearly erroneous error, and we don't believe that that showing has been made on these facts. Returning to the issue of discretion, I would direct the court to the Mooling case. In Mooling, as we've discussed, there is this presumption that the court understands, knows, and applies the law correctly, and specifically that the law relating to the crack powder disparity is hardly so inscrutable that a district court, particularly one that clearly understood the advisory nature of the guidelines, as Judge Collier did here, could not be presumed to follow it correctly. And again, that's a district judge ruling before Kimbrough, and in a case where the government argued that the court had no discretion, none, to consider the crack powder disparity, and the district court didn't even address it. In that case, this court affirmed.
Do you think it's okay for a district judge to have a stated policy of adhering to the guidelines?
A stated policy of adhering to the guidelines?
In other words, a district judge to say, the sentencing commissioners are the expert body, they look at these, and my policy is to adhere to the guidelines?
I don't think that that's what happened here. And to answer your question more directly, if in fact a district judge regards the guidelines as presumptively correct or mandatory, then we're in trouble. That's not where we are. Instead, we have a district court who regards the action or inaction of Congress and the views of the Sentencing Commission as relevant to how she's going to exercise her policy discretion, but not determinative on that question. And that's a key difference to focus upon in this case.
Can I ask you one other question, which is, as I understand it, the President and the Attorney General said that the ratio should be 1-to-1. And why doesn't the government then advocate for 1-to-1 in cases such as this?
Well, I believe in this case, the trial attorney took the position quite reasonably that although 1-to-1 is a goal towards which Congress should be proceeding.
But why does Congress have to proceed, given that under the Supreme Court's rulings, the district courts now have discretion to choose a ratio, and the government has the ability to advocate for the ratio? And as I understood it, the President and the Attorney General have said it should be 1-to-1, but AUSAs in this district, and I think elsewhere, are not following that stated policy and are not advocating one-to-one. Why is that?
Well, let me start with the thinking of a judge, if I may. While it is permissible for the judge to depart on these policy grounds and come down to that one-to-one ratio, Judge Collier here was looking for a principled way to do this, not just for this defendant, but for all defendants. And there's no guarantee that all the district judges...
I thought the principled way to do it would be to say that the disparity is unfair. It's based on a scientific misapprehension, and it's rooted in incorrect assumptions that were made in 1986.
That may be, but then we're left with the question of what number does that take us down to?
And well, here it would take you to the mandatory minimum, and I'm wondering why the government advocated above the mandatory minimum if the stated policy is 1-to-1. The
government did so because it regarded Mr. Tate's rampant rate of recidivism to be an aggravating case-specific factor. And as the judge...
Does the government advocate 1-to-1 in other cases in this district?
Unfortunately, I don't have the institutional knowledge to know exactly what we're advocating before each district judge in this district. No, I don't know.
All right, thank you.
Unless there's further questions on Mr. Tate, I can address Mr. Young's appeal.
All right.
In Gales, this court cited the Montañez case from the First Circuit. The First Circuit had a very good observation. It said, courts have thus far found it fairly easy to call serious efforts at full disclosure from mere pretense. And this is exactly such a case. In Mr. Young, we don't have a man who tried to cooperate by other means and provided proffers and was suddenly burdened with a demand for debriefing or had some unusual aversion to the medium of oral communication. What we have here is a man who held out and gambled. He took the gambit that Montaigne says you make at your own peril. That is, we had a much different argument below than we have up here. Below, he argued over the scope of what he had to disclose, and up here, he's arguing over the sufficiency.
So the now, government takes the position that this circuit should follow the First Circuit's lead here, that the district court must make findings?
As it has before, that I'm sorry.
No, we cited in Gales. We cited the case, but we didn't hold.
You didn't hold that. To which effect? That
the district court must make findings. Can't speculate as to what the defendant may or may not have known.
Well, I don't think that we have a situation here where there was any speculation. In fact, the district...
That wasn't my question.
Well, perhaps, I'm sorry. Perhaps I'm misunderstanding the question.
My question was, is the government suggesting that we, this circuit, should follow the First Circuit in requiring district court judges to make findings on a defendant's specific knowledge?
We would take the position that specific findings are not necessary in a case like this where it's totally implausible that the proffer being offered that the government drafted and the defendant merely, in which the defendant merely admits to the bare allegations of this offense.
So you think more was at stake than who his supplier was?
Well, we think that that's probably the most important thing that's not disclosed here. And every case that's every court that's considered the issue of whether the supplier must be disclosed has ruled that it does.
Now, I just want to understand what the government's position is. He said the government knew everything, so he really didn't have anything to tell the government. And I thought the point that the district court was focusing on and that the prosecutor before the district court was focusing on, that, you know, he had not disclosed who his source was or said that, you know, he just didn't have that information and gave an explanation as to how he obtained the drugs.
Well, in fact, his lawyer said below that he didn't have to disclose who his supplier was, not that he didn't know. And there's an affirmative disclosure obligation where the burden rests with the defendant to come forward with evidence showing that he's met the burden of truthful and complete disclosure under 3553F. And here we have a case where instead of coming forward and saying one way or the other, this is all I know, or I know more, we have a defendant who chose to speak through his lawyer and make the argument that I won't tell you more, not I can't tell you more. And that's a crucial difference. And when he made that gamble and failed, it doesn't merit the protection of the safety valve.
Anything further?
If there's no further questions, we respectfully request that the judgments be affirmed.
Counsel for appellant.
Good
Thank you, Your Honor. The government argues that whatever the ratio, it made no difference because this judge was concerned about Mr. Tate's recidivism and his criminal record. Nowhere in the record of the sentencing hearing or any of the papers filed is there a suggestion that that was the court's only concern. And the government did not request an upward departure based on underrepresentation of criminal history, and the court did not apply an upward departure such as that. I think unless a court said something very direct, such as, I don't care what the ratio is, your rate of recidivism or some other factor warrants a 100-month sentence, this court can't know how the district court weighed ratio, background of the defendant, all of the 3553 factors.
I'm going to be a little repetitive here, but why isn't the fairest reading of the transcript that the district court said in response to defense counsel argument, no, it's not 100-1, and then the defense counsel corrected that it's not 20-1 either, and the district court then was under the knowledge, okay, it's somewhere between 20-1 and 100-1. The precise ratio really doesn't matter because my job is to calculate the guideline range, which we all agree on, or the base offense level, and then to apply the factors, and the factors here, recidivism, the serious nature of the offense. And so if the district judge thought, okay, I should vary because I want to get to a precise ratio, the district court would have done that. But the district court, that was not the district court's goal, unlike some district judges, as we see in the post-Spears cases.
I think the judge was, obviously the judge was very concerned about his criminal record and recidivism. And I think that the record shows that she was comfortable in the neighborhood of 20-1. Mm-hmm. And 20-1 certainly was a number that was being thrown out by Senator Durbin, by Judge Friedman in our own court was applying that number. That is the area where she felt comfortable. I can't say why she didn't try to pin it down more precisely. Is it 20 or is it 25? Is it 30? Mm-hmm. But it's not something that was meaningless to her. It's something that she discussed at length. She said, I'm concerned about.
I thought what was meaningful for her was that it was not 100-1. I agree with you.
I think it was also meaningful.
To that point, I agree with you, but she satisfied herself that it wasn't 100-1.
I think it was also meaningful to her that it was close to 20-1. And I don't think that this court could say that she would have been, if she had known it was 70-1, she would have been satisfied with that. Mm-hmm. Mr. Tate was entitled to a sentence based on a correct understanding of the facts and the law. As to the plain error issue, the government argues that it was available to defense counsel to say it again, but there is no requirement in the rules or in the case law that a defense lawyer continue to raise the same objection. She knew what was before her. She knew what defense counsel was asking for, and she made her ruling based on that. He didn't need to keep bringing it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to address Judge Tatel's question about interpreting the record differently as to what precisely the district court held here. Everybody below believed that there was that Mr. Young had to debrief in order to qualify for the safety valve reduction. Mr. Young believed it because the court so instructed him that he had to talk to the government on Joint Appendix 134. And I apologize, I misspoke earlier and said 135. It's on 134. Mr. Young's counsel believed it and filed a motion to reconsider on this very point. There's a section called debrief where Ms. Katkish files a motion to reconsider specifically on the point as to whether Mr. Young has to talk to the government. And the government argued at least six times, four times in the May 8th, 2009 sentencing transcript alone, that Mr. Young might be eligible or would be eligible for the sentencing reduction if he sat down and talked to the government. Now, the government concedes that there is no debriefing requirement, but everybody below proceeded under the understanding that Mr. Young had to provide the information by sitting down and talking to the government.
Did the defense counsel below ever say something to the effect of, we're willing to provide you the information so long as it's in writing?
No, I don't believe that the defense counsel ever did so, but the understanding was that the information had to be provided in person during a conversation with the government. And if the court had simply said the information must be provided and didn't specify the form, then we don't know what Mr. Young would have done. Mr. Young may have provided the information in an alternate form. But years of a man's life are at stake because of the use of the word debrief and talk. Mr. Young thought he had to talk to the government, debrief with the government, in order to provide that information.
All right.
Thank you very much, Your Honors.
Thank you. We'll take the cases under advisement.